Hi everybody, my name is Chris DC, and what a treat this week to interview Brendan McSharry, who is editor of The Link and studied history and English at Lampeter from 1968 to 71. He has received an OBE for services to education and culture in Iraq, where he spent 4 years working for the British Council. Brendan was born in northwest London and explains why he wanted to study as far away as possible from the city. So he went to Lampeter, and he remembers the long train journey to Carmarthen and what happened when he once travelled with a Welsh lorry driver who couldn't speak a word of English. Brendan discusses his Irish background and how from childhood he can recall the fast pace of life in London and how he had hardly visited the countryside before going to Lampeter. In his family, he was the first of his generation to go to university. We find out what his parents did. He discusses Carnaby Street, how he became a voracious reader in later years, how he developed a love of classical music. He was captain at Lampeter of the cross-country club, and his school, on the other hand, didn't encourage debate. And he talks about the shock he received when theology students at Lampeter told him that parts of the Bible were not true. He recalls hitching in his Lampeter days and travelling to the former Yugoslavia. We learn about the Dominican sister at his school who taught him English and inspired him to read widely. Brendan then talks about the university lecturers who inspired him too, such as Bob Sharp. We learn about Brendan's life post-Lampeter, which included working for the British Council for 42 years, and we learn how he ended up in Iraq. And he recounts the time when the house three doors down was obliterated by a Scud missile. Brendan talks about how he has developed a worldview and is not a little Englander, and why diversity is so essential to having a strong community. He reflects on the time he met with a Lampeter contemporary of his who voted differently in the Brexit referendum. Then at the end of the interview, we learn that when he was young, Brendan wouldn't have expected that he'd end up doing the things he has. And he talks about how he became more ambitious as he grew up. And we find out what he thinks he would have done if he hadn't gone to university, as well as why he is so interested in the lives of others. So what a treat this week to interview Brendan McSharry for the latest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. My name is Chris DC. So it is an absolute pleasure this week to have Brendan McSharry. And Brendan, we've known each other, I think, for about 2 years through all our Lampeter Society endeavours.
Yes, yes. Because maybe longer, because I've been coming to the annual reunions for the last 25 years or so. So maybe we may have met each other at a reunion. Because you've been going to the reunions, the annual reunions in Lampeter for some time now, haven't
well,
you?
Well, actually, not that long. Surprisingly, my first one was in 2018. And although I was in Lampeter for 10 years, there was a bit of a gap afterwards before I felt quite ready. I think there was so much of Lampeter within me. I think I needed to step away, unpack, process. And then with a vengeance, not least, actually, I have to be honest, Facebook was an important part of that. I was able to meet up with loads of people who I was at university with in the 90s. And of course, through that, then I was able to meet many people from other Lampeter generations, including yourself. So it feels like now, right, you know, a part of my life that's never going away.
For good or bad. My point of view is good, you know, long live Lampeter, as it were.
So you were at Lampeter in, am I right, thinking late 60s, early 70s?
That's it, 1968 to 1971.
And what did you study when you were there?
History and English.
Yeah. And in the same way, so it sounds as though you had a bit of a gap. I suppose the reunions in their present form probably started around then. And that's exactly when you were sort of part of that whole movement, I guess, of Lampeter alumni returning to their roots.
Yes, although I think reunions have been I think the reunions go back to, is it 1938 when the Lampeter Society was formed? Margaret McCloy, who was at one point the chair of the Swansea Lambda Society branch. She'd been coming to the reunion for over 40 years. But there was a big gap between when I left Lambda and when I attended the reunion. Yeah.
And in your case, I know, and you may be too modest to talk about this, but of course I did come across in your biopic or your when you were writing something, probably for the Lamb, about your OBE. So yeah. How did that come about?
Well, I think that was, I think they said it was for services to education and culture in Iraq, because I'd had spent a total of about 4 years working with the British Council as the director of the British Council in Iraq, based in Baghdad. And then, surprise, surprise, they offered me an OBE. I was very surprised. I thought, oh, right, okay.
So how long ago was that? Was that in more recent years?
Yeah. I finished in Iraq in 2012. Yeah. So, and then from there, I moved on to Nepal then. So,
And of course, you're in Stuttgart at the moment. But what I'll do, I'm going to go all the way back to begin with, and then we'll come up to date. So along the way, we'll try and catch all of the different facets of your life and career trajectory. But do you want to say a little bit, Brendan, about how the journey started, where and when you were born?
Ah, right. I was born in London, northwest London, in 1949, which is going back a bit, and I lived in Hendon. In all of that area, there was a strong Roman Catholic community of Irish origin, needless to say. So I attended my primary school, secondary school. They were Roman Catholic institutions, I think when I decided I would go to university and study, I thought, I'd like to actually study somewhere that's miles away from the madding crowd, miles away from London. When I realised that Lambeth was quite rural and to boot Welsh speaking, I thought, oh yes, that would be worth experiencing.
Yeah. And I noticed from my time at Lampeter in the 90s, just how many of the students were from London and the southeast, because I was from Cardiff. So in that sense, I was relatively local. My journey was a far more provincial one. But I was amazed, really, at just how many, because, you know, even at the school I went to, not many people had heard of Lampeter. But I think it was a bit of magic, because Lampeter was always the kind of place where if you were prepared to travel a little bit further, you would have a far more enriching experience, because you'd be going somewhere where you're not likely to end up in the rest of your life, in the sense that, you know, if you have a job in the city somewhere or somewhere where there's more of a population, where there are more jobs, depending on whatever career you follow. Lambeth just felt like an opportunity to be in this most wonderful rural environment, where it was great for study, actually, because inverted commas, fewer distractions, although I guess that's all down to each individual's own, you know, penchant for finding distractions. But it was one of these sort of like almost pre-lapsarian places that just felt it was so untouched. It so much had the ethos of the 1800s and, you know, the founding of the college and Bishop Burgess, where I lived in my first year. Right at the top, yeah, and the room with the big window looking down over Station Terrace and the fields, the Magic Mountain behind. Yeah. So I had the most perfect time. And I look back on that and just think, maybe I stayed a bit too long, because I was there for 10 years in total. And of course, a lot of my friendship base had moved on. But looking back, those first few years, particularly when I really started to discover myself, you know, straight out of school, learning my subject and also just finding my sort of way through and embarking on that journey of getting to know the world. The world came to Lampeter as much as, you know, rather than necessarily the other way around. And it just felt phenomenal as a place. And how different was that for you, or maybe how similar was that to you in the late 60s, early 70s?
I think a similar sort of experience. I'd never come across anything like it. And I remember I had to go for an interview to join Lampeter. And I remember making this long rail journey from London to Carmarthen. And then from Carmarthen, you then take the bus up to Lampeter. And it was so, the countryside was beautiful. It was so rural. And when I went into a shop in Lampeter, they were speaking Welsh. And then suddenly they'd go quiet because they could see that, you know, I was not from those parts. And I'd never experienced anything like that before. That was it was quite amazing, really.
Yeah, and the same for me, because considering I was from Cardiff and had done Welsh at school, I was unprepared for the colloquialisms, the vernacular in Wales. And I, looking back, it's a bit odd that I spent so long there and didn't really learn the language. I should have done, really. That was remiss of me. But it was also, maybe if I, you know, it's easy to look back and say, if I'd known I'd be there for 10 years, I would have done things differently. But I, each degree at a time, as it were. So, but looking back, what a phenomenal thing. Did you learn Welsh at all when you were
no,
there?
I picked up a few words. I mean, I had picked up a few phrases from Irish, from my father. But I tried to at least pick up and replicate the sort of set routines or phrases. But I didn't really learn it. And also, I've never been any good at learning foreign languages. That's been one of my weaknesses. So unfortunately, I didn't end up learning it at all. But the cleaners would chat to you in Welsh, not that I understood much. I used to hitch from London to Lampeter and back again. And I remember getting a lift in Wales from a Welsh lorry driver. He could not speak a word of English. And I hardly had a word of Welsh. And we were driving in the night for the last stage to Lampeter. And I thought, gee, this guy, his only language was Welsh. And I thought, it was amazing. I was in a foreign, if you like, a foreign country in a sense. The fact that you were being exposed to a language you couldn't speak or understand.
Yeah, and I found as well that it was the kind of place where by day you'd have people from the United Arab Emirates, or you'd have, especially with the big Islamic centre that was in later years, which I was part of as somebody in the Theology, Religious Studies department, and Islamic Studies was a huge part of our endeavours. And then you'd also have the Chinese community, and of course you have the yes. Chinese centre that's there. Yep. So by day, and people from all over Europe. There was one night, I think I was in the student union bar, and I spoke to somebody from Germany, then somebody from Australia, then I was talking to somebody who was from France, maybe, and America, Canada, and then from different parts of England. But it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, by far and away, the majority of people that I was encountering were international. And I just stopped and I thought, if I was in the centre of London, even, or I was in the centre of Cardiff, you know, the chances are that I wouldn't get that same degree of international contact. I mean, the numbers were smaller. Lampeter is in no way on a par with the big cities, but you'd have the same ratio or the same distribution. Yeah. And yet it was also profoundly, not parochial, maybe that's the wrong word, but there's also very strong Welsh local presence. And in this very small town, it felt that by day you had this global dimension, by night it was a bit more local. And then and I'd witness this from my window sometimes in the town, and I could just see these very strange communities sort of all juxtaposing, but not necessarily coming out at the same time. And I found it fascinating. I just said, like, I should have been an anthropologist.
I must confess, Lampeter is let's call it the Lampeter campus of the University of Wales Trinity St David, I think is certainly the most international part of that consortium, that group. Yeah. So without a doubt.
And did you find, I mean, in your day, where were most students from? Were they mainly from England? Were there quite a few from Wales? Or did you have many from overseas?
Only in my day, only a few from overseas. I remember there was, a few from France, a few from Germany, one from America, and possibly one or two, curiously enough, from Australia. Apart from that, we're from all over the UK, certainly, and of course from Wales, but not so many from overseas. But that I know that was to come later with the Islamic Center and the is it the Center for Sinology or
yes,
the Chinese one.
Yeah. What about the Irish roots? Because you mentioned your father being Irish, and also the name McSharry. So so you were born in London, but there's obviously an Irish pedigree, an Irish background.
Yes, yes. So, and I met a few Irish people there. Yes, certainly. Including one who was a lapsed Catholic, as I were to become later. But his uncle was one of the three vicars general of the Liverpool Archdiocese. And he was, although he was a Liverpudlian, he was a pure Irish roots, McKenna, and also from a strong Catholic background.
What about your earliest memories then? What, before Lampeter, what are the things that you remember from growing up in London? What are your particular earliest memories?
Let me see what they were. It was the sheer size of London, and there always seemed to be a sort of fast pace of life there. I certainly did find London, especially when you went into the centre, very cosmopolitan. I remember also in the school I attended, there were lots of Irish Roman Catholics, but not just Irish, but mainly Irish. And the influence of the church was very strong. I'd hardly ever visited the countryside until I went to Lampeter. I think I may have been to the countryside maybe once.
Yeah. It's an interesting notion of counterpoint, isn't it? I always think that because I'm someone who but although I'm from the city, I suppose I was never really immersed in the city. I'm not somebody who used to go shopping or to the cinema in those days, those sort of things. But Lampeter was just something that was quite different to what a lot of my contemporaries were doing. Many of them were either stayed in Cardiff, so ironically had a more tempted not to use the word parochial, but I don't think that's quite fair because that suggests that limitations were actually sometimes like during lockdown, you can do some amazing things when you're, you know, locked into a particular framework and don't have the same opportunities for accessibility and transport. But it was interesting that a lot of my friends stayed in the big city. But I seem to have, you know, and they'd be going home to their parents of an evening after they finished their studies. They'd be going onto campus for their lectures and then leaving again and didn't really know all that many students. Whereas I'd be living in a community of people from all over the world. And we'd be going out of an evening, going down the pub, going down different places in the town and going for wonderful walks to the Falkendale. And I just kind of thought I never left after 10-week terms and thought, I haven't made the most of it. Quite the opposite. So I used to find in a funny way that I was having to retrain what a lot of my contemporaries were doing because they were like, why would you go all the way over there to study? And I could easily just turn the question back at them and say, well, you know, I seem to have, you know, my journey may be more westwards, but it feels that it's opening up all sorts of avenues, which I wouldn't have got if I'd just stayed in the same part of Cardiff, living in the same estate. So, so in that sense, how interesting that from London to Lampeter, you probably found it literally a breath of fresh air.
Yes, definitely was. Now, there were some people who did go to Lampeter who from big city that had the opposite experience. They found it difficult to adjust to life in Lampeter, but I didn't. I loved it because it was so new to me, so different. So,
yeah, no, and of course we know a good colleague of ours who's on the business committee who had that same experience. Yeah, I'm intrigued by that. And also in his case, how interesting that all those years later, he's become very, you know, it's almost as though he's come full circle that whatever experiences he may have had in the 1960s, now he's at the, you know, he's at the cutting edge, he's at the very heart of all of the Lampeter Society endeavours. So there's a sense, I think, that anybody who goes, whatever they're feeling at the time,
over the course of a lifetime, you sometimes think, well, you know, what are the positives? We all do that, don't we? Like a checklist, the good and bad. Do we stay here? Where do we go? Where do we stay? But I do think whenever I meet people outside of Lampeter in Cardiff, many of them are in Cardiff, I do find that everybody's got some wonderful story, some wonderful narrative that they want to impart. And it's like they've taken a piece of Lampeter with them, and you pick up on the same conversations that you had in my case in 1994 when we all graduated. So we've all taken that with us.
Yes, I would agree.
What about your parents? Because you mentioned your father's Irish connections. What did your parents do? Did they have a very did they go to university?
No, they were solidly working class. My father was a labourer or construction worker, and he came to UK to find work. Because the tradition in Ireland is that the land would go to the eldest son, and the rest would leave Ireland in order to find work, because there was no work to be had otherwise there. And my mother was in service all her life. So I was the first of my generation, myself and some of my brothers went to university. We were the first. And that's an interesting challenge. And I, being the editor of The Link now, I've just received a piece from, I've forgotten his name, I think from Birmingham, who studied geography. And he was the first of his generation. And he said it was just to apply and go to university was a major step for him.
Yeah, and in that sense, same with me, because my sister went to Lampeter. We both went to Lampeter. She's 3 years older than me, but we were both first generation university. And you're right, it's life-changing. And also, neither of us left the profession either. We both went to university at 18, and in that sense, we stayed in higher education. So our parents are both, you know, sort of like, they could never have imagined that happening because it wasn't what they had experienced. But it also felt the right thing for us in a way that the opportunities may not have been there for my parents when they were the equivalent age. But it does feel that we were breaking the mold, and that's obviously the same experience that you had.
Yeah, and you know, we were the inheritors of the Labour government of 1945 to 1951, the beginning of the welfare state. And I was able to apply for and get a full grant because our parents were pretty poor. But the generation before would not have had that opportunity.
No, and that was very much my case, because I was the last year of the free grants, or it was frozen at the previous level. Yeah, so I went in 91, and in that first year, we had a grant, but it was frozen at the previous year's level. So that's the year that student loans were introduced. So although I took out a very small loan, you know, I didn't have anything like the same payback challenges that subsequent generations of students have had. What about other things like growing up? Because one of the things that I was obsessed with, I mean, off the scale obsessed with, really, was like the charts, music charts, listening to the radio. And I didn't go to live gigs. I did buy records, but it was always sort of, if I heard something on the radio and I liked it, then I buy the material form of that in the form of a record. But what about you growing up? Was the music of the day important in your development?
No, I don't think so. Although I tried to, once I was earning money, because I had a gap year before going to Lampeter. Once I started earning money, then I wouldn't buy records, because we didn't have a record player or anything like that back at home. But I would certainly listen to music, go to the pubs and listen to music. Music didn't have a big effect on me. I think possibly what did was the revolution of not just the Beatles. What was that famous street?
Carnaby Street. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that had some impact on me, which I just found very, very surprising. But no, not music as such, because we never listened to music at home. We never read at home because there were no books. And our parents were not really educated. They both, well, my father left school at the age of 12, and I think my mother left school at the age of 14. So, you know, you didn't have that environment to sort of encourage you to listen to music and read. But subsequently, I became quite a voracious reader, and I also was quite a devotee of classical music. But that was, you know, after, in a way, some of that occurred, those new influences occurred when I was in Lampeter, when I was away from the home and the my background. It's then that I got exposed to, you know, wider cultural influences, if you like.
And did you find in that sense that when you returned home during the holidays, for example, did you find that your way of looking at everything had changed, had broadened out?
It had, yes. Yes, yes, it had. And I remember I would use vocabulary, not deliberately so, that were obviously part of educated speech. My mother and father were sort of slightly taken aback by it.
Yeah. Yeah, yes, I can well imagine, because it's you know, you're into university and it's a very formative age. I found this at 18, and sometimes you just suddenly, it's the freedoms, but how you use the freedoms that seem to be the important thing. Because some people, you know, yes, there were always people I knew who would blow their entire grant in a week, because they'd say, look, I've got all this money, I've never had this sort of money before. Oh, well, what's sort of, spend a few more pounds, and then after 2 weeks they're bust. But on the other hand, it was like, okay, I learned to be really careful, and I'd go out every night, or pretty much, but you know, I would just be very sensible. So of course it was just sort of setting clear boundaries, and that of course is something, yeah, I think as it has followed me through for the rest of my life, really. Especially, like, I couldn't have done the degrees that I did, the PhD and so on, unless I was sensible with money, because I had no money, really. I was living off virtually nothing, but in a way, I had the resources in place to know how to be sensible with very little.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
And so in your case, it may not have been music, but was there anything similar, maybe not reading at that age, or was there anything that took its place, that there were ways of, you know, forms of entertainment that you had that would, whether on your own or with groups of friends?
Yes, we certainly visited all the pubs in Lampeter, and also I travelled around a fair bit of Wales, because I was captain of the Harriers Cross Country Running Club. Yeah. And that meant you would visit the Royal Naval Reserve at Broady, you'd visit Cardiff University, Bangor, Aberystwyth and so forth. It was fun, because you were not only meeting people, but you were having a drink after the race or the running exercises. But also, I think reading and discussing, because there was no tradition of really discussing much when I went to school, partly because it was a very traditional Roman Catholic school. We were all working class that were at that school, or most of us were, but the school did not encourage debate. You learnt your catechism. You would learn almost by heart the apologetics of Catholic doctrine, but you didn't discuss at all. And one of my memories of Lampeter was it actually in Burgess Hall, because I'd meet up with students, ordinands at Burgess Hall, and other theology students who would, for example, say, well, of course, you know, the Bible is highly flawed. A lot of it is just not true. And this was a shock to me. In a way, I was doing things, either discussing or reading as part of the programme. And that was something new for me.
Mm.
to discuss and to put forward an argument and to defend it. It was something I had never indulged in before I went to Lampeter.
Yeah, because I was in the odd position of having studied theology at university, but meeting other Lampeter students in some cases, not necessarily doing theology, but who had a problem with some of the kind of things that we were doing, as in, you know, we were quite freely offering, you know, biblical criticism, and we were not, you know, it wasn't a seminary. The whole point was that we were studying good critical materials. And in that sense, I did feel that I learned to move away. Interesting that I did that, because I was heavily involved in my local parish church, my Anglican church in Cardiff. But I moved further away from that because I found that the intellectual study of theology was good. And I didn't want to compromise that, because I used to find it very awkward when people would ask me questions about how I could reconcile my studies and faith. And I actually thought, well, I don't have that problem because I'm not circumscribing the boundaries of what my subject is. So I needed to step away from any faith background that I had in order to be able to say, well, I'm studying this. I don't want to say, I've got a student here at Kent some years ago whose parents told him which courses he could and couldn't take because some of the titles of those courses seemed to be quite, you know, one of them was on religion and sex, one was on death of God, and they thought, well, we're not comfortable with you studying these things. So to have a parent telling a university student what they can study. So I kind of stepped away from some of those and found them very awkward conversations. When somebody would say, you know, you're studying something which for some other students, as I say, not necessarily doing theology, was a conflict with their belief system. And I had never come across anything like it before, really. So university was a real coming of age in all sorts of ways.
Yes, agreed. Academic discipline, you know, I hadn't written, although I had done my A-levels, and I hadn't written too many essays. And I'll never forget my first big essay I had to do, I think it was on the 17th century for the history department. And the guy and his superior, Professor Chanderman, who God rest his soul, has passed away, they crossed out most of it, and they said, there are whole paragraphs here that say absolutely nothing. And this was a shock to me, you know, because I just was not used to logical reasoning, to developing a train of thought and developing an argument. So, yeah.
But it sounds as though you had some wonderful conversations and interactions with the divinity students.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. And have you kept in touch with many of them?
With a few I have, yes. Yes, I have. And I used to go to chapel. I suppose it's because I always went to church, the Catholic Church in London. So, I remember experiencing some great sermons, particularly from, I don't know whether you remember D.W.T. Price, who wrote the History of Lampeter in two volumes, I think.
I actually interviewed him for this podcast series at his home about 2 years ago.
My God. Yeah. And I used to listen to his sermons in the chapel, as I did of Professor Renoundin, and they were just amazing.
Yeah, no, he was phenomenal because he'd written the authoritative history of the college. And of course, he was teaching. He's a very lovely chap, and it was such a privilege to catch up with him a couple of years ago. But you're right. And, you know, the history was oozing through his fingertips.
So
you were a contemporary of his in the sense that you were a student. He came to Lampeter, didn't he, in around 71. Yeah, so your paths sort of just about crossed.
Yeah, I think he came actually tail end of 69 or 1970, right. Yeah. I believe. So
yeah, that would make sense. Oh, yes, because I remember him talking about being on the very last rail journey that took place.
Oh, then he came earlier because the last rail journey was 1965. Mm. Yes, I thought he was there for the whole of my time, actually, because they closed the line from Carmarthen to Lampeter. 1965.
Yeah. I think the last passenger train may have been then, and maybe then the last train. But you're right. So, but in your case, you Were there trains at all then? Because in the late 60s, the line was there. Okay, so it was a moribund line, but the line was open, or at least it was there was track there.
There were occasional cargo trains, possibly. Right.
That's it. That was
certainly
it.
No passenger trains. Yeah.
So in that sense, so you mentioned the time when you had a lift, I think you said, with the lorry driver. But how did you get about then? Because obviously there was no, I mean, my dad worked for the railway and I had all these free passes, which were no use in Lampeter. But in your case, how did you get about? And was there public transport?
There was public transport. And in the early part of my time at Lampeter, I would use public transport. But thereafter, I just hitched everywhere. And in those days, you could. Now, it would be a highly risky enterprise.
Yeah. Hence my pausing, because for that reason, because you think of all the maybe I've just watched too many horror films, but yeah, you're right. But in those days, I think you touch on something really important, that in terms of the facilities of the amenities, and also maybe the trust in those days that people would have. I mean, these days, you would never. I mean, I used to walk to school, and my parents, you know, these days it's unthinkable that you'd let a child walk to school. You'd always take them in the car. Yeah. But again, that's just going back 25 years, 30 years.
Yeah. Yes, I walked to school quite regularly. And, you know, parents would think nothing of it. And I hitched all around because, you know, in order to eke out my grant. So, I hitched everywhere. And I found it really, really interesting. Yeah. The people you meet.
Absolutely. Yeah. It sounds like you've got some particular experiences there to draw on, of some conversations that you would never have had if you hadn't hitched.
Yeah. And people from all walks of life. And I remember also in 1970, the year before I graduated, I don't know whether you remember Owen Jeffries. Myself and Owen Jeffries, we were contemporaries, went hitching in Europe. All the way from London to, those days it would have been Yugoslavia, when that was still a country, all the way to beyond Dubrovnik. I can't think of the other places. And we hitched the whole way, and that was amazing. And I never forget, we met a couple who would, the guy, the husband or father, had fought in the war and had lost a leg. And he him and his wife could still joke about it. And I said, oh, yes, I had an uncle in the war who fought in the war. The guy could speak really only German, he really couldn't speak English. But he could get across through gesture about losing his leg, and but at the same time, he had enormous respect for the British from his, you know, his experiences in the war. So,
What about inspirations as well from, well, either school teachers? Because I'm interested in how you ended up going to university in the first place, because that may not have been the common experience of many of your peers. No.
I think probably the one teacher that inspired us to go to university was, her name was Sister Veronica. She was a Dominican sister. And she taught English, and she encouraged us to read widely, to think of going to university afterwards, after finishing school. Mm. And she gave us a lot of encouragement. And not only her, but the head of the school was this, she was a real battle axe, Sister Catherine, also the Dominicans. There were Irish teachers there as well, what we call the Navvies, but the Sister Catherine, and she said, I remember her saying, you've got to be ambitious. And she said, in an Irish accent, she said, remember, if you can't go through the front door, go through the back door.
It is funny, isn't it, how there are things, the things that people advise people impart, which you remember, but they may not even themselves possibly imagine that they'd either said this. But I found this with people. You say somebody, you know, if it wasn't for you giving me that bit of advice, I wouldn't be where I am now. And their response is, oh, that's very kind of you, but I don't remember ever saying that. Yeah, but it changed my life. So, you know, and then you think, well, do you know, yeah, even if you didn't say it, I feel better having invented it. Because I need someone to have, like in a film sometimes, you know, you need somebody as a counterpoint, or you need someone to, yes, you know, to be the inspiration for something. But what about at university at Lambeth? What about other teachers, any particular lecturers who you remember?
Well, certainly, let me think. Don Jones, who was the history lecturer for many, many years, from him I developed a love for medieval history. And that was thanks to Don Jones. I remember Professor Borman, and some sort of decried him and said, oh, no, he was a boring old fart, and I don't think I enjoyed his tutorials and his lectures on Shakespeare. So, and that inspired a sort of love for Shakespeare. And also A.J. Ryder, Dr. Ryder, again on the history side, I thought they were quite inspiring as lecturers and thinkers. Oh, and Bob Sharp. Let us not forget Bob Sharp.
I was taught by Bob Sharp.
Right.
In philosophy,
and he taught us logic and philosophy. Because in those days, part one, your first year, you did three subjects. I think it was philosophy, history and something else, I can't think what it was, and he taught us and, you know, encouraged us to think logically and so forth, and I found his lectures quite fascinating. How did you find him?
Well, very much, because he was very convivial. I find him a very easy person to talk to, and he taught me, I think in the first year, but I did a module or course, as we called it in those days, on the Victorian crisis of faith. And it was taught by Barbara Dennis and a few other colleagues in the English department. And we had Malcolm Smith, who taught us on Marxism.
Right.
And Bob Sharp, who did a week on utilitarianism. That would have been 1993.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So I knew him a little bit. I know he sadly died, I think, in about 2005. I can't claim to have known you very well, but wow! So we both, and David Walford in the philosophy department must have been there.
As philosophy. Yes, he was. He was. Yes. Yeah. And so, there's an interesting piece in the link of some years ago of someone, I think of your time, maybe a bit later, drawing sketches of the philosophy tutorials and lectures that Walford gave. Mm-hmm. And those are interesting, cartoons and sketches.
And indeed, in my interviews, I've obviously interviewed a few Lampeter people, and there are some common names that come up, and caricatures, really, people who were like that, really, I think. Well, actually, Andy White, who's the Brummy comedian, who will be coming to reunion next year, hopefully.
All being well, yes.
Lockdown notwithstanding. Maybe he was one of the ones who did those, but he certainly talked about some of the funny, surreal things that would go on in David Walford's seminars. But there's a whole history and legacy of this. And I think, because one of the things that I discovered, particularly at university, is eccentricity, in the sense that when I was at school, if you were different from the crowd, then you were seen to be a bit odd and people would make fun of you. When you're a bit older, you need that to stand out. So being a bit eccentric is actually a hallmark. It's a wonderful thing because people are talking about you. People think, wow, this person's got some incredible, you know, something that nobody else has in the same sort of way. And Lambeter was full of those. And I include myself in that, of, you know, sort of going to Lambeter and feeling, you know, whereas at school, you might be the sort of person people are sort of looking at you thinking, you know, you're saying some very strange things, or, you know, you don't have the same interests as everybody else, or you're very quiet. Working or whatever, and then at Lampeter you find that everybody is like you, and it's the most liberating feeling you could have. So it was wonderful to meet such a wonderful array of people who had very quirky ways of teaching and fellow students, and we all kind of felt that we belonged, and it was a very special place at the age of 18.
Yes, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I can't remember, he may have been around then when you were there. He was the head of the philosophy department, and he was very eccentric. Professor, I've forgotten his name, begins with B. And he was, you know, your typical absent-minded professor. And his lecture would ramble, and he'd say, if you steal a bike in Lampeter, everyone knows who's stolen it, you know. And this led on to a wider point. I can't think what it was, but was he there then? I've forgotten his name. Not Barraclough, Professor. It'll come to me.
Yeah, well, let me know. We had a David Coburn, we had a Rockingham Gill was the I think he was the head of department in my time. But
right, yeah. Right.
But what about your profession, Brendan? Because you touched on this earlier on, because you, am I right in thinking that you were working for the civil service?
Effectively, yes, yeah. And for the British Council.
So what happened after? So talk through what you did post-Lampeter.
Well, post-Lampeter, I, for 6 months, I was looking for a job because the recession had begun, one of the many. And so I worked for the local council parks department for about 6 months after leaving Lampeter, and then got a job with the civil service, the Department for Employment, when Macmillan, the son of Harold Macmillan, was the Secretary of State for Education. And then after 2.5 years of that, I'd got bored, and I thought, no, I must do something very different. And it's then that I decided I would do PGCE at the University of Exeter, and which I did. And after that, I thought, right, I'll just go abroad. And so I went to Sweden to learn to teach English, the foreign language. Of course, I had no background or training in this, so that was quite a struggle. And after Sweden, I joined the British Council at their teaching centre in Milan, northern Italy. And thereafter, and I thought, I'll come back to Britain. This will be short-lived. But it wasn't. You know, I spent with the British Council, I spent a total of about 42 years with the British Council.
And you must have some amazing memories from that time, especially with all the world, the hot spots in the world. I mean, Iraq, for example, that you were based at.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Iraq, I remember when I first went to Iraq, because I had two separate postings there. One I was the head of the teaching centre for the British Council in Quito, Ecuador. They asked, would anyone be interested in becoming the head of the teaching centre in Baghdad, Iraq? So I went there. And I remember two instances. One night when I was sleeping in, I've forgotten which, you know, district of Baghdad it was, and I heard this massive explosion, and it was a Scud missile, because the year was 67, 68, which was the last year of the war between Iraq and Iran. And a house, only three houses down, a house was completely obliterated. Then another occasion, I was working in the office in Baghdad, and my assistant director of studies there was Margaret Hassan, who sadly was executed by the the Al Qaeda, whatever it was, some years later. And we were sitting in the office, and suddenly the windows burst. There'd been a bomb just outside, and we ducked underneath the tables. That was quite a shock. Then my second time round, sorry, it's always about bombs, but that's the way it was. again, I was in the office. The office for the British Council then, by 2010, was in the British Embassy. And a missile landed just outside the British Council block, but didn't go off. And if it had gone off, I wouldn't be here with you now talking.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's...
Did you have lots? I mean, do you have flashbacks to a lot of those years? Because I mean, I've had a wonderfully, blessedly kind of secure life in the sense of, well, obviously we've all had our horrible moments, but I mean that's off the scale. I mean, existentially, I mean, to be in a place of that kind of danger when you know that, you know, what must be going through your head is that, you know, when you always think of like the government advice about don't travel to certain countries unless absolutely necessary, and you're probably thinking, gosh, you know, what was I thinking of?
Of yes. Yes. I mean, it was still interesting. I mean, Iraq culturally is very, very interesting. I mean, the history of Iraq is pre-Egyptian. You know, you're going way back in time. And the culture there was very strong. And the people I found were really, really friendly. So, you know, there were good moments as well as bad moments, but I think on balance, I thought, no, it's worth it. This experience is worth it. You know, again, when I was in Yemen, I had 5 years in Yemen as director of Yemen, and our senior teacher had been kidnapped, him and his wife and son. Now, in those days, that could be fatal, in some cases not, and eventually he and his wife and son were released. They were on their way to the airport to fly back to the UK. And I was involved there in, you know, trying to start negotiations to for their release. So and yet, you know, some of the most wonderful people I ever came across were Yemenis. They really were.
And now you're back in Europe and in a but clearly not retirement, because of course you're unbelievably active and brilliant in all that you're doing with the Lamberton Link, and you have a background in marketing, don't you, in that sense?
I do, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Which is why I take an interest in it. And also I do some part-time work for the Anglo-German Institute here in Stuttgart. And I'm also helping a group of sisters, handmade sisters in Zambia, who are doing their PhD studies. So I give them some support.
Well, I mean, just on that note, because as we start to wrap up, I want to look at some more philosophically based questions about all the things you've done. I mean, would you say, Brendan, that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey your life and career?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Overall positive. Yes. Yeah.
And what about the question related to that about negative experiences? Because I always find it interesting, and not necessarily at university, but generally in life, about whether the negative experiences that you have, and you mentioned Iraq just now, things where you look back and think, wow, I've done something. Whether that's nostalgia is another matter. But it sounds like you made an enormous contribution in it. Well, obviously you've got an OBE, you've done some amazing work. But how do you unpack all of that about the way that we negotiate our pasts?
Yes, I'm not sure. I reflect on it to an extent, how in trying to determine what impact it's made on me, I'm not sure. I find that still difficult to say. What it has done, I think, though, is I think I've developed a fairly worldview, only because for 42, 43 years of my life, or no more maybe, I served abroad. I was working overseas. So I think I've developed a worldview. I'm certainly not a little Englander. So when I see the current antics of our government, I think, oh, God, it fills me with horror. And I think that I appreciate the different cultures. You know, diversity is absolutely essential to have a strong community and a strong country or even a strong world. There has to be diversity, and that has to be protected. And that means accepting minorities, accepting people with either different views, different sexuality, whatever it may be. And I think a respect for diversity and for equality and so forth is really, really important.
Yeah, because I found when we had the Brexit debate, the referendum in 2016, that was the first time when it really struck me that, you know, on campus, everybody I met agreed. We all wanted to stay in Europe, and there was a very clear sense of what we all had in common. We were all like, gosh, you know, what a horrible referendum. Let's hope it goes the way we want. But when the result went differently to the way every single person I knew voted, it suddenly just made me think that there's like a whole world. It's almost like I'm in an ivory tower, the very thing I always say to my students that I don't believe I am in. But then it struck me that maybe I am in an ivory tower, because I didn't see that coming. And the very things that we learn at university about inclusivity and diversity and human rights and looking after the rights of people who don't have a voice, suddenly you find yourself in a world where some of those very things that the antithesis of that seem to be in the ascendancy. And somehow they're not, rather than people look to people in university as a guide, like, come on, you show us the way, that's your job, you know, show impart some of your wisdom, suddenly it was like, we don't need you. And I found all the things that have happened in the world since then have confirmed my idea that you know, I have a privileged life.
Yes, I suppose. Yes, yes. Amazingly, you know, I think it was the last reunion. Was it 2019 or 2018 at Lampeter? A contemporary of mine who graduated the same year as I had done, it transpired in the course of the conversation that he'd voted for Brexit. And my jaw fell open. I said, "You're joking." And he said, "No, myself and my wife," and she was also a graduate of Lampeter, felt very strongly that being in the European Union was not only constraining, but it was foisting upon us decisions that we're not party to, and so forth. Mm. And I was absolutely amazed. Because I thought, surely all university graduates from whatever era would have voted to remain, but no. And and I think he was slightly annoyed, certainly taken aback, when my jaws fell open, and I said, "You must be joking."
Well, actually, that's interesting, because I'm sure there are people I work with who voted against it, but they may have kept their mouths shut for the simple reason that they Yes. knew that there would be this kind of a backlash. So I think that those people may, on the day of the results, may have just thought, you know, there you go. You see, you make all these assumptions. You think you're so clever and we'll get the result that you want, but just look at it, there's another world out there, and you haven't Yes. given Yeah. any, you know, you haven't embraced that or understood that. And gosh, we, Yeah. we've all had an awakening over the last 3 or 4 years for sure. But what about the question, Brendan, about whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? In other words, when you were a child, would you have anticipated all the things that you've done with your life?
No, never, never. And I'm not sure, when I went to university, did I have any ambitions? I think, yes, I might have. I think I had some sort of ambition to enter into politics, which I never did, and I thought, oh, one day, you know, I might be a minister or something, but I didn't go down that line. So in a way, I didn't have a clear future plan or clear ambitions, but as I progressed in my life, then I suppose I became more ambitious. So then eventually I ended up as regional director for the British Council in Middle East, North Africa. So, but no, I don't think I had any strong ambitions. But I wanted to get ahead and better myself, and our parents wanted that as well, of course. because it would have been some sacrifice for them, for you to, you know, not earn money, which you could give to them and go and study at university. So, but did I fulfill my dreams? No, because I don't think I had dreams. I don't think. I was never a creative person, and I didn't do too much dreaming, because I think the school and parents discouraged that. They said, you've got to keep your feet on the ground. So,
No, and what about turning that question on its head? What advice would you give to your younger self? Or, you know, because I suppose you on the grounds that you obviously had an incredible life, but it could easily not have gone that way. Or, you know, do you kind of look back sometimes and just reflect on the alternative life that could have been led if you hadn't gone to university, you hadn't followed through on all of those great ambitions?
Yes. I think if I'd not gone to university, I think I would have joined, I would have become a white collar worker, I think. But I imagine that I wouldn't have risen very far and would have just thought, well, the main thing is you've got a job, you know, that's the main thing. And that was one of the views pertaining then, of course, you know, first and foremost, you must get a job and stay in the job. And that, above all else, is important. There was no real notion of job interest or, looking to fulfill yourself then. So I suppose if I hadn't gone to university, I think my life may have become quite sort of normal pedestrian, possibly.
Which it most certainly has not been.
Have you had that feeling?
Have I had that feeling? Yeah, because being first generation university, I mean, my dad worked on the railways, and when I was really young, I thought I'd be a train driver. So, which would be great. But I also really wanted to be on the radio, and yet that's the one thing I haven't lived. You know, I've had a wonderful career, but there's always that from childhood. I've never been able to shake it. I mean, even I'm talking to you now with a microphone in front of me, and obviously we're doing this virtually because of lockdown. And in a sense, I suppose I am living out that dream. But there is that sense sometimes of, you know, my parents would never have anticipated that my sister and I would go to university and then stay at university. So it could have worked out very differently. And I'd still be living in Cardiff, I'm assuming, because I've got many family members who've never left Cardiff. And I've been, you know, and I moved to West Wales and then I moved to Kent, where I've been for the last 16 years. So it's nobody would ever have anticipated that I'd be, certainly not me.
Is DC a Welsh name?
No, Irish. It descends from Southern Ireland.
Ah, right.
Although both my parents were born in Wales, but it goes back to the 19th century.
Right.
In terms of when they then moved over to England and then Wales.
And they were Church of Ireland, not Roman Catholic. No.
That is a good question. There definitely is Catholicism in the family, but that's something that I'd have to trace back.
Right.
Because I was brought up an Anglican, I don't think that goes all the way back.
Right. Yeah.
But I've got one more question for you, Brendan, which is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think both. I certainly look forward, but I look back, idea of looking back is not looking at my past life, but looking at the lives of others. So I have a very strong interest in history, in biography, and so forth. Which is why I like this present job as editor of The Link, because I can look back on the history of the Lambda Society, which, you know, as I mentioned before, goes back to 1938, if not before. And or the history of the college, which went back to 1822. And I just find that fascinating. The more distant the past, the more I love to read about it. So, but it's not my past life I look back on. I look back on the lives of others. and the way of life that they had at the time.
Brendan, it has been so spectacular to catch up with you for this latest edition of my podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.